Those who have not had the honor of meeting, Rabbi David Lichtenstein is really one of the most fascinating people I've met. He has a beautifully balanced life of being both a very successful entrepreneur, real estate developer, very out there in his field, and at the same time, an accomplished Torah scholar and teacher. He studied in some of the great yeshivot in the world here in New York and in Jerusalem, and he has spent many years sharing his beautiful Torah wisdom with tens of his thousands of followers. He has a podcast that I very much encourage you to get on. It's called Headlines, and some of the beautiful Torah that Reb David, as he's affectionately referred, shares on that podcast has been written up in these books called Headlines. You can get them. It's really, really worthwhile. But I just really wanted to say at the outset that besides the great wisdom you're about to hear, okay, there's a tremendous balance. I know I'm setting you up for a fall here, but he's got a tremendous balance between a secular professional pursuit and at the same time a life devoted to Torah and mitzvot and really serving the Jewish community. And I just really want to thank you in advance for being here. It's a big zechus, an honor for us. Rabbi David Lichtenstein, everybody.
Well, that was a real setup, wasn't it? So I want to talk about a question. No nation has fought with more determination than the Jews to keep what they have. And no nation we are the oldest religion. All the other religions in the world, and most of them are children of ours. According to some Chazals, even Hinduism and Buddhism are children of Avram's. He sent them to the Far East, right? So what is it about the Jews that has given them so much determination to hang on against so much adversity? You know, and usually loyalty comes from some type of, it's a payback of sorts. Like, if you look at the most loyal brand, it's Louis Vuitton. People wait in hours to, and I guess it's, you know, both maybe the quality and maybe the cachet of walking around carrying it, so it engenders loyalty. Well, what is the Louis Vuitton-like quality of Judaism that has allowed us to be so? So let me share with you a New York Times article from a decade or two ago. When is it? 2011, more than a decade. I'm good, thank you. But they did a poll, who is the happiest man in America? They did a poll, a Gallup poll, right? And they said like this, the happiest religion are Jews. Right, Muslims, by the way, have the lowest level of happiness. I guess they're counting in the women and they're making a median, I guess. The Mormons are very happy, the Roman Catholic, but the Jews are. Now, of the Jews, Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, the Orthodox are the happiest. Interesting. Gender, men are happier than women. Slightly higher, you know, right? 67 compared to just a little bit over women. Okay, race, Asians are by far the highest level of well-being, followed by whites, Hispanics, blacks, and everybody. Marital status, married people are considerably happier than unmarried. Okay, people with children are happier than people without children. Interesting. Age, people, the older you get, the happier you get. Interesting, right? Over 50 is happier than under 50. Income, over 100,000 is happier than under. Okay, we can around that. Geography, of all the states, Hawaii was the happiest state. Understandable. Employment, if you own your own business, you're happier. And taller people are generally happier than shorter people. So the, so the sense, I'm just repeating a Gallup poll. So the New York Times decided
said you have to be a tall Orthodox Jew living in Hawaii.
Yeah. So, so that with children, married, with children, self-employed, and they did, and they went to Hawaii, and they found one guy. And they also said people with a sense of humor are happier than people without a sense of humor. So New York Times actually sent somebody, a reporter, to Hawaii. They went to all the shoals, I guess. And they found a guy. It says his name is Alvin Wang. He must be a Ger. He's Asian. And they called him up and they said, you know, Mr. Wang, you must be the happiest. You are the happiest man in America. He hit every single one. To which, as having a sense of humor, he responded, this sounds like a joke. Okay, you could Google it in the New York Times. Happiest man in America, Alvin Wang. Okay. But what does that mean? To me, it says if the Orthodox Jews are the happiest people, right, it would give us some understanding of why they have brand loyalty, right? And I want to talk about that. And why does it have to do with Purim? We know it's called Yom Kippur, which is Yom Kippur. And Purim, so they say Yom Kippur is Yom Kippurim. It's the day like Purim. Which is very interesting. What is the similarity between Purim? And there are a number of, but I'm going to give you a new one, and that is that Yom Kippur is the day where we do things out of intimidation, fear. Like, you know, when you're little, your parents say, eat healthy, eat your broccoli or else. And then you get older and you say, hey, you know, I think eating vegetables is probably pretty healthy. You know, as much as we don't like broccoli, right, for most of us, right? Mm-hmm. But we realize that eating vegetables is actually healthier and eating, you know. So then we do it out of appreciation. So Yom Kippur, it's about serving God through sort of the first time the Torah was given. It says God held a metaphorical a mountain over their head, and it was do it or else. And then at a certain point, they said, hey, this is pretty good, right? So I want to talk about it. What is it about Purim that we discovered it's pretty good, right? So everything that I'm saying, by the way, is gathered from various different Jewish sources. I see myself more as an agglomerator here than a machadish, okay? And by the way, there was a lyricist in Lithuania. His name was the Dubna Magid. He used to have a metaphor for everything. And he once taished a pasuk. He once translated a pasuk. The pasuk says like this, Lo osi karasa Yaakov, if it's not me you're talking about, Yaakov, ki yagata bi Yisrael, if you're struggling with me. God is talking to the Jewish people. And he gives a metaphor, and I'm going to change it a little bit to make it a little more modern. A guy gets a job, and he's told to report to a certain address and in the village. And there's two entrances. And in one, there's a delivery service of, you know, they're delivering, I don't know, some very heavy items. And the other one, there's a club. And he shows up, and he goes into the wrong one. He goes into the delivery one. And the next day, the guy says, no, so how was the job? He says, oh, it was terrible. He says, something sounds wrong. Like, if your job was in the club, you should have come out glowing. Mm-hmm. Right? So God says to the Jewish people, if you're struggling with Judaism, you must be doing something wrong. Which I think is pretty powerful, being that we think of religion as, like, what is, when you tell your college kid about religion, what does he think? It means no sex, no McDonald's anymore, like a whole list of don'ts. Like, what could be happy about this? I go try to explain to my friends why they do this. They think you probably somewhat became insane. Like, you know, it's a me generation, a feed. You know, we feed ourselves as much as we can. So something that tells us what not to do, is ironically, you wouldn't think that would be happy. But that's what the pasuk says. If you see something about Judaism that you don't like, you must have the wrong address. And by the way, I believe that to be true. When a rabbi tells you something and it just doesn't sound right, he may have it wrong. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's what I say to a lot of like the ultra-Orthodox. No, that doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. Right? Judaism is about, it should feel just and right and you should feel fulfilled. Right? So let's talk about, and I want to talk about a little bit of happiness. So, you know, there are different types of happiness, right? And afterwards you'll tell me whether you agree or you don't agree. And the simple type, the simplest type of happiness is money, sex, jewelry, gems, watches, you know, and everything you see in the Rob Report, or everything you'll see in a magazine. I don't know if anybody reads magazines anymore, but like glittery and shiny, and you know what I mean. And that's really how we see happiness in America, right? And by the way, every one of the levels of happiness also has a counterfeit, right? Yeah. So, what's the counterfeit of all this material happiness? Well, the counterfeit of the material, I would posit, is that if a person likes a really great coat, you know, I bought an Artitrex coat. I'm always cold. I wish I lived in Florida, right? So I buy that because it's just, Google is like the warmest coat, right? But some people buy a coat only because it has a name on them, right? In fact, can I say over a joke that's politically incorrect? It's a story. It's politically incorrect to this crowd. You sure?
Please.
So I actually rented space to Louis Vuitton. But if it wasn't Louis Vuitton, it was LVMH. And I met the head of LVMH because I had a bunch of outlet malls and he wanted to be in them. And he told me that he does more business in China than anywhere else. And I said, why? And this Frenchman tells me, he says, when you have 1.5 billion people that all look identical, the only way they know who they are is when they're carrying my bag. Amazing, right? <Yeah. clears throat> So to me, when we use clothing or jewelry, not because we inherently we see the food as good, but it's I'm doing it because I have to show you who I am. That's the counterfeit. And everything counterfeit ultimately breaks. It snaps. You know the story they say over that there was this Jewish fellow, he was a farmer someplace in Russia, and he had to go to a big city. As he went to the big city, and somebody told him on the way back, you know, it took you so long to get here, the train goes back. So he bought a ticket, and it was a sleeper train. And he told the conductor, he said, you know, wake me up when we come to Yaroslav. He says, it's 4 a.m. He says, yeah. He says, okay, I'm putting you into this cabin, and I'm going to wake you up a quarter to four. So the guy gets undressed. He gets into bed over there in the sleeper. And at 3:45, he wakes him up. And he gets up. And by accident, there was also, who else was sleeping in his cabin? A Russian policeman. So he put on the Russian policeman's clothing instead of his own. So he comes back home. He looks in the mirror and he tells his wife, Razel, you're not going to believe this. Instead of waking me, they woke the Russian policeman. Right? These are the people who sort of, when we use clothing as a prop, if I do this, LVMH has told me who I am. Well, my uniform tells me who I am, etc., then it's the counterfeit of what is materiality does provide pleasure. So this is, interestingly, by Jewish standards, this is what we would say the simplest level of pleasure, of happiness, etc. I call it hierarchies of joy, right? Now, what's better than a Patek Philippe watch? And this actually happened to me, too. I'll tell you an interesting story. Had a guy came to my office, and he wasn't meeting me, he was meeting somebody else. And somebody calls me in, he was the president of a bank. He says, you're not going to believe this. He says, this guy, he's married to a channel, 2 or 4, so whatever, anchor, an extremely beautiful woman. But the guy tells me he didn't want to have kids. And his wife wanted very much to have a kid, so they had a kid. And he said, and now their marriage is falling apart because he didn't want the kid, and he blames the kid on the whole thing and this and that. So I said, let me talk to the guy. I went in to the guy. I said, oh, he is telling me we had such a great marriage, and I don't want that. I said, I have an idea. I said, a very simple idea. He said, in fact, you know, the kids are expensive. We were hoping to buy a penthouse. I don't know now. I said, I have a very simple idea for you. Let's put your marriage back in shape. Me and my wife were finished having kids. I would love to have another kid. And I'll buy your kid off you, and I'll give you right now a check for $3 million. And I pulled out my checkbook. Just give me your name. Do an agreement right now. The guy looks at me and says, are you crazy? I said, look, let's just do add up the pieces. You said you didn't want the kid. The kid is ruining your marriage. You wanted a penthouse. This is one check solves all three problems. And I said, and I'm good for the money. Yes, Charlie. Charlie said, he's good for the money. I said, got all red. He said, this is insulting. And he got all, you know. I said, so it seems that you do really see some value in the kid, right? Right? So what does that mean? So what is bigger than, let's say, money? Or, right, is love. Like if somebody had a kid and the kid, God forbid, needed a serious treatment, would he sell his Patek Philippe watch to pay for the thing? So, in other words, what I'm looking for is that if we're saying that Judaism is about happiness, and it's ironically, what can God do for me? What can life do for me? Right? And it's not about sacrifice, but it's certainly not about materialism. So what values is it teaching us that we say, oh, that is a real value, and I don't want to give it up, and that's what's creating, quote-unquote, my grand loyalty here. Because Judaism does not talk about watches, or jewelry, or food, materiality in any way. Right? So what could those values be? Well, it could be love. Right? And why do I say that it could be love? Because what is the first mitzvah given to the Jewish people as a whole? Right? The first mitzvah given to the Jewish people is the mitzvah of the family meal of the Paschal Lamb. Bring your family together. Right? So, and to Jews, what do we read on Yom Kippur? You would think on Yom Kippur, the holiest day, by the laning, you would read something about angels. No, what do we read about? It talks about incest. It talks about cheating. Because Judaism recognizes as a foundation of our religion, it's about love, family life, right? And these are all the time bombs that'll explode these. And I'll share with you, by the way, an interesting thing. That, you know, the power of love and the power of family and why it's so sacrosanct, we call God as holy and marriage as holy. So we place love on a very high pedestal. And I'll tell you a story. There was a New York architect. He went to see the Sequoia Forest. And he looks at these trees, and I've seen them. They're like 300 feet high. They're 50 feet around. I mean, you could put 20 people to hold them. And they're thousands of years old. So he says, wow, thousands of years old. Hurricanes must have come through here in thousands of years. I mean, we have now, you know, in California, a number of times a year. And storms, and he says, the roots, I design office buildings, must go down hundreds of feet. And he says, no, they don't. And you could Google this, the sequoia trees go down 6 feet, the roots go down. That's what the rain, and he said, it's impossible. He said, no, you don't understand, there's something amazing. They grow in strands, right? And they send out roots like cables, at 6 feet, to their brethren trees. And when storms come through, they offset the load by sending it to the rest of the strand. And that's how they could go down 6 feet, but last thousands of years. Which is almost a metaphor for the power of family. Like when storms come, right? Even a dysfunctional family sends out very powerful roots. Right, which is why family is so sacrosanct, right? And it's a metaphor almost for the Jewish people. We, look what's going on in Israel, how we. So we see the power of love is such that it can pull us through almost anything. Right? And it supports, it's the scaffolding that keeps us doing well, which is why, again, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we speak about the holiness of marriage, etc., right? What is the counterfeit? We said the counterfeit of materiality is when it's not really materiality, it's just to find self-identity. What would be the counterfeit of love is infatuation. love sort of without meaning, or pornography almost, you would say, right? Where we have connectivity that is really false, right? It's when the check doesn't clear anymore, suddenly it's gone, right? That would be the counterfeit. And people make that mistake, by the way, very often. They have somebody who they love, who loves them deeply, and they exchange it for the counterfeit. I think I spoke about Shabbos, the Cracker Jacks box. Did I think about it?
Yeah.
It's a good story, though, no? Do you remember when you were a kid, not the count, your mother bought you Super Sugar Bombs for breakfast. I don't know why she bought them, but, you know, she was in asleep at the counter, right? And then you go home, and it shows, like, first of all, they're fantastic. It's basically all sugar and milk, the whole thing, right? And then on the back, there's, like some scene, and it has like an alien shooting with a light ray gun. And then you're reading the back and you say, if you collect 4 box tops and $2.50 and you send it in, you're going to get a ray gun. You can get your own ray gun. So you go to your mom and you say, Mom, I need more Super Sugar Bombs, more Super Sugar Bombs. And it's 4 weeks later and your teeth are almost all gone. But you have now 4 box tops. And then you get $2.50 from your father, and you send it in. And every day from school, you come running home, and you check the mailbox. So this happened to everybody here at some point, right? And then finally, one day, a box comes, and it has your name on it, and you're 8 years old, and it's like, and you run in, and you go into the kitchen, and you open the box, and you pull it out, and there's like this gray plastic thing there. And you're thinking, that's not what it looked like on the box. Right? And then you pull it out, and you pull the trigger, and after 2 clicks, the trigger breaks. You had this happen to you? And you're like, then you bang it, and the thing breaks in half, and it's nothing, it's a piece of plastic. And you look at the box, and you say, that wasn't really real, was it, huh? And how many people do you know who've exchanged somebody who really loves them for the super ray gun inside the box of a snapper jacket, of a box top, right? So that is what we would call the counterfeit love. But the love itself, we know, you would, like, people for money, you know, they would give everything for a child's health, for a parent's health, for you, right? So love is stronger. Now, what's a higher level of, on the hierarchy of joy, of fulfillment, of love, than love, right? I would say it is self-fulfillment, self-activation. You know, you see somebody, they have an idea, and they have a startup. They have some really great idea, and it's they fall in love with it, and they stop eating, they stop sleeping. It becomes like a mania, like it's a type of a self-realization, right? I'm using all my psychologists talk about it. That famous Czech fellow with the unpronounceable last name, you know, what I'm talking about Sichel, Czechel, Millie, right? The zone, you know what I mean? The real. What
play.
Is it? What?
It's play. It's like being in a state.
In a state of, right, you just...
The flow.
You don't go home. You don't see your family, you know. And you see, like, with a lot of great artists, like, you know, both artists like the Picassos or the Ayn Rands, the writers, they go into this zone where they're so entranced with what their creation, with this thing, and how every fiber in their being is suddenly alive, and they're, right? And sometimes in life we do have that. And it's like opium, but it's real. You're creating something, right? And that is something. And you would tell that person, would you exchange this state for love? Well, he says, I haven't seen my family in weeks. Would you do it for money? What are you, crazy? It's like this is, I'm alive. I'm as alive as I could be, right? And this is really something that's very powerful. And what does Judaism, by the way, say about this? Judaism says something interesting. It says, Adam Nivra Yechidi. Every man is a one-time event. Now, the Talmud wrote this around 1,800 years ago. And nobody understood it, really. What do you mean everybody's a one-time event? Well, thousand, 800 years later, they realized, well, everybody's fingerprint is really one of a kind. And then they said, beyond fingerprints, we know your DNA is one of a kind, right? Now we know when you go to the gym and you put your eye there, your eyeball is one of a kind, which is a metaphor for your vision is one of a kind, right? Whereas everybody has a different view of the world. No two people have the same view. Do you know that now they have no two people's ears are the same? There's a company that is a startup that what they're trying to do is they want to know when a bank calls you and they want to know who they're talking to. By the way, it bounces off your ear canal, they know who you are. Everybody's ear canal is shaped different, as well as the shape of the ear. So they said everybody, and what is the meaning when we say you are one of a kind? It's another way of really saying you are a one-time event. Everybody here, nobody ever was like you. Nobody is like you. And nobody will ever be like you. Astounding. Talmud to say this almost 2,000 years ago, before they had all the physical proof of it, right? And what do we say in, let's say, the davening of Yom Kippur? Maisi ish ufkudasai. Everybody has their own mission. Right? No two people have the same mission. Right? Which, by the way, is somewhat of an antidote to envy. Envy is one of the big beers in life, right? But when you think of it, could Mars really envy Jupiter? Or could Jupiter envy Venus or the Earth? It seems like almost absurd. Like if we recognize that each of us was brought here for their own mission, right? It makes envy a little bit seem a little strange. Right? It's I have my what I'm here for, and we have to recognize what try to earn our and recognize what our mission is. That's a job in itself. But we each have our own mission. We're born one of a kind. You know, Reb Nachman famously said one of his more outrageous sayings, but the Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say something not that dissimilar. He would say, this is an astounding statement. Really, it's just worth like remembering this statement. And he said, Reb Nachman said, the day you were born is the day God decided that the world cannot live without you. About it, an amazing statement, right? The day you were born is the day that Rabbeinu Shalom decided that the world cannot live with. There's some need that you fill that nobody else can fill, and it's absolutely necessary, right? And when we hear this, we recognize, like, you know, there are 613 commandments, except for killing another person or idolatry. Or a carnal sin like adultery, right? Those are three cardinal sins. But Shabbos, kosher, you're allowed to violate any one of them to save a life. Because a person really is a one-time event that never was. And if you kill a person, you've killed something in the world that will never be again. You've destroyed something. And if you save something, look at the positive side, you saved something that never will be again. So Judaism really believes in this concept of self-actualization, of finding your zone and finding why you're here and what it is. And for a mother, it could be for her children. For a teacher, it could be whatever it is. Whatever that. So this joy of self-actualization, of self-fulfillment, is something that as a religion we see as a real value. So if somebody said to you, you know, would you forsake your mission, whatever your Picasso type, whatever painting your thing, for love? You would say no. For money, no. So suddenly we're starting to step back into sort of the interior of Judaism and saying, like, why did people were so enraptured by it? Because there were levels of fulfillment in the hierarchy of fulfillment that make a cheeseburger look so superficial, right? That make a Patek Philippe watch seem so silly, right? If I can be, in my world, I'm the Picasso of my world, right? So beyond love, we already pierced love. Now we're going, and now you say, and I am, it teaches us my purpose is here. My mission is nobody else could fulfill. There's only one person in the universe that can do what I have to do. Think of how empowering that is when we hear that. Right? Just to give you an example, going back to China, where the Louis Vuitton bag is the most, people will literally sell a kidney for a Louis Vuitton bag, is you have two different cultures. In the Orient, in these collective cultures, they say, the nail that stands out gets hammered down. The goose that leads the flock gets shot. And we are saying, there is nobody who will ever be like you. You are the only one. But just think of the two, how empowering one is and how diminishing the other one is. And when somebody says, there's something here that's feeding me, that I can understand why people see it as such value that they're willing to sacrifice their lives for something that teaches us, right? The absolute, it's like, if I don't want you to copy me, and I don't want to copy you, I don't want to have any follows on my thing, because I don't think you should be following me, and I certainly don't want to follow you. Do you know that there was a great rabbi in Poland? His name was Rebbe Rabunim of Pszczyzna. In Poland, they would say, until the Baal Shem, all of Hasidus was an explanation of the Baal Shem. Right? And after the Rebbe Rabunim of Pszczyzna, they would say, all right, all of Hasidus is an exegesis of he is. That's how much they held of him. And one of his saying, he said, if God came to me and he said, Binim, that's, it was his first name, Bunim, I want to make you like Abraham. I want to make you like Isaac. I want to make you like Jacob. I want to make you like Moses. He says, you know what I would tell God? I would say to God, you already had an Abraham. You already had an Isaac. You already had a Jacob. You already had a Moses. I'm interested in being Bunim. Think of that. God wants to make you like Moses, and you say, no, I want to be Bunim. And it replaces Bunim with everybody he has name. He doesn't want you to be, if you're a woman, not like Sarah, not like Rivka, not like Rachel, not like Leah. He says, I want to be, what's your name? Nava. He says, I want to be Nava, thank you, Lord. I would prefer to be Nava. I want to be the most amazing Nava imaginable, the way I could be. Whatever talents you give me, that's who I want to be. Which is shocking in a way, because, how could you say you wouldn't want to be like the patriarchs? But this goes back to this concept of self-actualization. It's actually a really tremendous value, right? So now we have self-actualization. So we said, would you trade the money for love? Of course not, my kid. Would you trade love for self-actualization? No, I'm just my kid. I'll see him a year later. I'm just in my thing. Okay, but there's another hierarchy that's higher than that. What is that? Different ways you could phrase it. You could call it truth. You could call it justice. But let me give you a thing. You're painting this incredible painting, this incredible Picasso. I was in the Met, and there's a Picasso painting there. It's considered the most valuable painting in the world. They said Google says it's worth $1.2 billion. That's what the guide said. Right? You're painting some Picasso. You're a Picasso. And somebody taps you on the shoulder. He says, look, I have inside information. You know what? There's going to be a bus full of kids going down some road. You have inside information that when it goes around the turn and there's a cliff there, some terrorist is going to jump up, grab the wheel, and pull it over to things. You could be sitting there, grab the wheel, save them, and push this guy off. Would you interrupt your painting for that? And I think most people would say yes. And what is that? There's a concept of truth, of justice, of doing something that is absolutely right. There's a movie that just came out about Sir Nicholas Winton. I actually went with my wife to see it. You heard of it, right?
Yeah, I heard of it.
One Life. Did anybody hear of it? It's the story of a... And the actor who plays him is like some really good-looking actor. It's not true. He was a short, pudgy little fellow. Right? Well, that he plays him older, but I'm saying that the young guy is a very tall, good-looking guy. And he was a failed banker. He had been at 5 different banks, had failed. And then he became a stockbroker. And he has to be in Austria for some reason. And he's in Vienna, and he reads the writing on the wall. They're going to be killing the Jews. And he just somehow, like using mirror and tape and you know, mirrors, tape and mirrors, he sets up a kinder transport. And he saves the lives of 679 kids. It's just astounding how a person could pull so above their weight, you know, and do things that you, when you see him later in life, played by Hopkins, you say, like, you did that? A cat, you know what I mean? And there's a, like an amazing scene, it's on YouTube, you could watch it, the true scene, where he's invited, he's interviewed by the BBC, and it's in a big auditorium, and he says, is anybody here saved by him? And the entire crowd stands up, right? Or a child or a relative, you know, because it turned into thousands and thousands. The chief rabbi of Jerusalem, Rabbi Weiss, was saved by the kinder transport. Yeah. So here's a story. Now imagine this person, if you could say to him, would you change it for a Patek Philippe? Mite nishes, kol hoin besa, yboiz yavuzulai, right? Would you trade it for love? You wouldn't see your kid again for a whole year. Like I say, 6 7, right? Would you trade it for self-actualization? Right? Would you, the ability to do, like, see, like, just truth and goodness and right at one moment? Right? So, we have here an entire hierarchy of joy. And by the way, each one has its counterfeit, by the way. I was telling him, I was telling the rabbi on Shabbos, I said, you know, people get sucked into, say, Venice Foundation. I mean, it's not a bad thing, I guess, but like, you know, as things go. So I told the rabbi, I said, there were once a bunch of college kids, and one of them was like really like very pious, and like, and he read in the newspaper that somebody by the name of Morris Kaplan, a homeless man, had died. And they're burying him in some potter's field in Jersey. He says, Morris Kaplan. I mean, what religion do you think this guy is? Morris Kaplan? And it says he was homeless for like 20 years. I mean, do you know how much this man suffered? And is anybody going to be by potter's field when they bury him? We're going to go. So he got 10 friends together, and they rented a van, and they took a few guitars, and they took a few bottles of scotch and some candles, and they said, we're going to do something amazing. And by the time they got over the bridge, it was already late till they got started, and it was already late afternoon, it's turning towards dusk. But they get lucky. They see the guys digging, and they're lowering into the grave, and they start covering it, and they come running out of the van. And they say, stop, stop, stop. So what stop? We want to sing a little, and we want to cover. Okay? So they cover the grave, you know, the thing. And then they start singing, Kumbaya. And then they sing some more Kalbach songs. Baruch Inafshi Es Hashem. Lamana Chayvariya. Anybody here know Lamana Chayvariya? Lamana, you know, some. And they start singing, and then they said, let's make a dance. And they dance, and then one of them makes a very fiery eulogy. And he talks about the haves and the have-nots, right? The oppressed, the unfairness of life, and everybody's crying, right? And then they make a l'chaim. And then they get back into the van, and they all go back, and they did something amazing, right? And when they leave, one of the diggers looks at the other diggers, and he says, you know, I've been installing septic tanks for 30 years, and it's never happened to me before. Right? So, so So sometimes justice and, you know, doing right also has its. I mean, I'm sure all those millions of people marching from the river to the sea feel they're doing something just, right? I mean, just as a sidebar, the United States killed 300,000 Iraqis because they were looking for weapons of mass destruction, and there wasn't a single march. Like, and there were no weapons of mass destruction, you know, that also, just among all the other, you know, the 600,000 Syrians gassed, et cetera, right? So these are all the septic tanks that we can replace for real justice. So we have here a hierarchy of what is meaning, of what is fulfillment, and what is joy. And when every layer you get to, you look at the one below it and you say, come on, that's not the real thing. That's just very superficial. And each one, even love of a child compared to saving 670, that's, you know. And it, so each one is a shadow, a penumbra of the one below it, above it, right? And so I'm going back to Judaism and I say, what is it? Like, it doesn't sell sex and it doesn't sell Patek Philippe. What do people find in it? And the answer is, you know what? That stuff, Patek Philippe's and all these things, it rubs off very quickly when you start bumping into the... You're sort of going, you know, economy class if you pick that type of a route. And what's, by the way, the highest level when we go past justice is a relationship with God, which is hard to actually, you know, to explain. But those who have a real relationship with God wouldn't trade it not for justice and not for self-actualization and, you know... I used to tell my kids a story. Has anybody here heard of the Baditshuva Rav, Rav Levi Yitzchak Baditshuva? He's one of the great rabbis in Russia, you know, in circa in the times of the Baal Shem. And I heard a very beautiful story about him from Shlomo Kalbach said it. He said that he loved God more than anything. He used to pray. He would go into a trance, go into other worlds. And... the Baal Shem had one grandson, two grandsons. One was called Baruch of Mezhebuzh, right? He had two grandchildren who sort of... And Baruch of Mezhebuzh was a very proper thing. And he knew all the Torah of his grandfather, the Baal Shem. So he would come, and so Levi Yitzchak Baruch would always send letters to him. I want to come spend the Shabbos for you. He had some of the Torah of your grandfather. And Baruch HaMezhebuzh, he said, please, he said, listen, Levi Yitzchak, I know you. You daven, and you jump, and you scream, and you make a commotion. My shul is very like, I davened once in, what's it called, Park Avenue, the synagogue on like...
East Side, West Side.
No, on the West Side, Lincoln Square Synagogue.
Lincoln Square.
So I come from yeshiva, so I said, Amen, Yehesh, I said it loud, and the guy comes running over to me, shh. No noise over there. So he said, you know, you make a commotion when you daven. When he used to daven, he used to scream. He would jump on the table. He would wave his hands. He would turn red. He would jump up. And he didn't know which world he was in at a certain point, right? So he said, I promise I will be so good I won't. Okay, he said, soon you could come for Shabbos. So he came to him for Shabbos. And Friday night, you know, when they say, you know, Bowie Chala, Bowie Chala, he used to start screaming, Bowie Chala, you know, to the Shabbos, come in. Yeah. And I'm not allowed to do anything, so he put his hands by his side and he just followed very quietly, like in the Lincoln Square Synagogue. It was very neat. And then when you say Vishamru, which is right at the end, you know, before you say Shemon Esra, he would go into a different orbit. And he kept himself saying, okay. Finished davening, and then they had the meal, the tish, to 1,000 Hasidim there, and they put him next to the Rebbe Baruchel, but Kiddush, Rebbe Baruchel said Kiddush, and they gave him the coast to say Kiddush, and he, again, by Kiddush, he would scream and yell. He kept his word. And then they served the food, so the waiter comes around, and the waiter served it, and then the waiter comes, and, you know, they have sweet fish and salty fish. In Poland, they served sweet fish. And in Russia, they did like spicy fish. So the waiter comes to the Rebbe, to the Levi Yitzchak, and he says to him, Rebbe, do you love sweet fish, or do you love, in Yiddish, you say, do you have like the salty fish? And they could see he started holding on to the table. And he was like shaking. And he couldn't hold himself anymore. And finally he jumped up. And he gave a scream. Love fish. Levi Yitzchak only loves God. He started jumping up and down and saying, Levi Yitzchak only loves God. And the fish flew to the ceiling. And all that stuff, the gelatin of the fish flew on the ceiling. And the chassidim was seeing in shock how onto the spotless shtreimel and bekesha of Rebbe Berchel.
The gel
is dripping down on him. And everybody thought he would get very upset. You know, if landed on his talus. And he said, how could I get mad at somebody who only loves God? Right? And according to legend, they say that he never washed his talus the rest of his life. And that talus was passed down from child to child until the Minchas Alazar, buried before World War II, he said, I see a big darkness coming to the world. I want to be buried in this talus. And he was buried in it. But that's the people who had that relationship, which is a very high relationship. Is imagine that trading that for the watch or the starlet or whatever it may be. So at the end of the day, there's Yom Kippur, the days that we serve God. Look, it's like eat your broccoli. And then Purim is when we've come to recognize that there are values that are so much bigger than something shiny. And they require intelligence and depth and understanding to appreciate meaning. Right? So let me come back to my question. My question is, why have Jews held on all these millennia, in the light of such a... What engenders such loyalty? Right? It must be values and joys, a hierarchy of joys that go well beyond the superficial. And that's really what we celebrate on Purim. The recognition that our religion gives us so much more depth and so much more values and so many more levels of joy that many in the world would ever appreciate. So what do I say to you? Happy Purim.
Responses, rebuttals?
Rebuttals?
If anybody have any questions, please. You have a few minutes for questions?
Yeah, sure.
Does anybody have any... please.
So, I was listening to you talking about materialism, right? And a bag that defines people, a watch, whatever. So I'm looking at you and you're wearing a yarmulke, so I'm thinking to myself, okay, so is that like your materialistic thing? You know, like you wear this yarmulke. And then as you start going through the levels of happiness, you realize how that yarmulke ultimately leads you to the relationship with God, because like it's materialistic, then you have like love, meaning you wear it, you have so much love to wear it that it can even put you in harm's way, but you're still going to wear it because you have this love for Judaism, self-actualization, like you know what your mission is as a Jew in this world reminds you, and then like truth and justice, you know, from like always doing the right thing by wearing a yarmulke, like people are watching and you always need to be doing the right thing, and then ultimately like your love of God. So I think like as Jews, even sometimes when you take something that's material, it elevates you to that highest level through this course that you're talking about.
Beautiful.
Beautiful thought. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
Okay, so could you maybe, because we're talking about balance in the beginning, which really hit close to me, because I've been in a, whatever you call it, the phase for like a year, you know what I mean? It was more with work, right? That was like the most important thing. My life, like for maybe a couple years in my late 20s, but like just maybe walk us through your 20s and 30s. Like, I'm not sure when you got married, you had kids, and just how you balanced. Like, I don't know, like when you really focused a lot of your energy with your business and stuff, but I just want to like talk about that a little bit.
You know, a guy called me up and he said, you know, he doesn't really have time to learn that much or daven that much, and he works at a law firm in New York, and they work him like an animal. It's one of the big firms. And he really feels terrible about it, and what could he do? And I said to him, I said, you know, so why don't you move to, let's say, Memphis or some place down south where housing is a quarter the price that it is here and everything, and then you'll have more time to learn. And he said to me, well, there's no good yeshivas there. I'm going to sacrifice my kids' education in Memphis, like, or someplace in, I don't know, pick some southern city or, you know. So I said, so, and what type of a community? There's no community there. So I said, so what you're saying is you're working, you've taken this job and all these responsibilities because you want to be able to live in a Jewish community and send your kids to Jewish schools and pay triple the price for your house, etc., right? So doesn't that mean all of your work becomes holy at that point? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that holiness is a very misunderstood word. You know, many people we think are holy maybe aren't, and many people who aren't are. And I said over a vart, I said on Shabbos, that I know that the rabbi liked a lot. I said that it says when Esther came to make the Megillah, I'm sorry, when they wrote Megillas Esther, she said, I want it to be in my name. It should be called Megillas Esther, because they could have called it Megillas Mordechai. And Rashi says, I want it in my name. It's very important to me. So the simplest way to understand it is, it's like, geez, like she just wanted, like, sign her artwork. You know, don't... I want to sign my artwork. I don't want somebody else to sign it. It's me. It's one way. And I saw Reb Tzadik HaKain of Lublin, a Hasidic writer of around 200 years ago. He writes something amazing. He said, think of Esther's life, right? She was a young girl, Beis Yaakov girl. You know what a Beis Yaakov girl is?
Yeshiva.
Like a yeshiva girl. And she's taken to live, pretty much against her will, to a drunk brute who is the emperor of Persia and half the world. And she has to live with him till she dies. Right? So she's living with a guy. Right? I don't think he kept Shabbos, do you? Sure, no. Doesn't seem like he kept kosher. I wouldn't imagine he kept any mitzvahs. Right? I mean, he was a really bad guy, Achashverosh. There's a lot of, you know, he was a murderer. He was, you know, like a Saddam Hussein of sorts, right? And she's considered a prophetess, and the Megillah is in her name. And what's the message? She says, the message is, she's saying, I want it in my name. I want people to know that you could be living with a guy, you could be not keeping Shabbos, and not keeping kosher, but you're doing it because you have no choice, and you did it to save the Jewish people. And that is holy. And that's astounding, isn't it? And she lived that way the rest of her life. So holy is very, it's, you know, what's your situation? And, you know, God wants us to do our best. He wants us to do what halachically is correct. And halachically, she was allowed to do, and she had to do what she did. Mordechai said, this is what you have to do. And that could be holy. So somebody could say, I'm in a situation, sure, I would love to come to Rabbi Weil's shiurim 6 times a week, but my law firm doesn't let me, and I have to support my family. Well, that's holy. Holiness is very... In fact, one of the holiest people I ever met... I'll tell you an interesting story. When I went into business, I owned a building in Newark. Newark was a lot more dangerous then than it is today, right? And the city, for some reason, didn't pick up the garbage in my building. So I called up a lawyer. He said, you know, it's very random. Some buildings they do, some buildings they don't. I said, so what should I do? It's a fortune. He said, well, you could sue them. I said, how long will that take? He said, around 10 years. See, I said, I'll be so bankrupt before that ever happens, right? Like, in general. So somebody gave me an idea. He said that the entire town hall of Newark is black, except the head of the garbage department is a white guy, and he's Jewish. An old white guy, right? And make an appointment to see him. So I did, and I come in. Everybody's black there. I'm the only white guy in the whole building. Big city hall. except I come into this guy's office, and he's white, not religious. His name will come back to me. It was Mike something or other. And I started talking to him, and finally I said to him, what are you doing here? Like, you know. He said, I'll tell you what I'm doing here. He said, the year is 1948, and I'm graduated law school. I'm studying for the bar. And then I start reading that, you know, there's going to be a war in Israel. And the Arabs said, as they always do, that they're going to kill all the Jews and throw them into the sea. And they have no weapons there. I mean, the kibbutz literally had no weapons. They used to stand with brooms, you know. I heard a story once. A guy told me, he said, there was a guy, he was given a broom to guard the front of one part of the kibbutz. He's standing there with a broom holding it like a gun, and he sees something over there. And he says, stop or I'll shoot. And the motion keeps coming. Stop or I'll shoot. This is your last chance. And the guy pops out. Who was it? It was a friend of his. He says, why didn't you stop? I could have shot. He says, they told me I'm in a tank. So this is the weapons they have. So what happens? So this guy, he tells me they have nothing. So what did I do? I went around. I rented a van and I went to gun shows and I collected money and I started buying guns. I filled up a van full of guns and I sent it to Israel. Furniture, I marked it. I did it a few times. He says, yes, I'm studying for the bar. The bar is like in a week or two, and there's a knock on the door. My wife comes in. She's all pale. She says, there's somebody here. Come in. Two guys with the blue suits and the blue faces and the FBI. We're arresting you for gun running. Right? So he says, he gets pulled up in front of a judge, an Irish judge. Judge looks at him. Mike Krieger. That was his name. The from the garbage guy. He says, Krieger. You're Jewish, right? He says, yeah. He says, the last thing we need is another Jewish lawyer. He says, if you agree never to sit for the bar, I'll just, no jail time, I'll just make it, you know, we'll let you go. So he says, so I agree not to sit for the bar. And I came home, and my wife says to me, what are you going to do now? You spent all our money for law school. And I opened up the Star Ledger, and there was an advertisement there that they needed somebody, an assistant, in the garbage department. And that's where I've been for the last 40 years. So is this a holy guy or what?
Sure.
Yeah. He basically sacrificed his life, right, to be able to supply. So I think that holiness is a very complex thing, and it's best for God to judge. But really, we see from Esther, it means doing the best we can in our situation.
Did you get the garbage in your
filter? And he actually did start picking up the garbage.
He got garbage.
Question for, what is like something you do that more than other things deepens your relationship with
that? That's a hard question. For me, it's learning. Like, you know, everybody has their own way to relate. I relate through studying. Some people by praying, some people by doing good deeds. And I try to mix it up, but for me it's more about studying than anything else. Like sometimes when I'm sitting and I figured it out, and that's when I feel like, oh, there's a connection. But I think it's very personal. Everybody has, you know, their own way of connecting to God. You know, from Passover to Shavuos, right, is 49 days. Right? And we count those 49 days. Every day we make a blessing. Today is the first day, the second day, the third day. Now, some of the commentaries, yes, they said, you know, we count 7 years of Shemitah. It's not done individually. The Bezdin,
the Jewish court
counts for the people. He says, here everybody counts individually. Like, why? And I think that the answer is, Passover we were slaves, we were pagan, and we're marching towards Sinai. The path to Sinai. I think everybody has their own path to Sinai. So everybody has to count for themselves. Your path to Sinai is not my path to Sinai. And your holiness is not my holiness. in your relationship, where you encounter God, is not going to be where I encounter God. It's a religion that's very personal in that respect. Happy Purim, everybody. One more question, yeah.
Okay, so...
last one. Thank you.
The hierarchy, right? So spending time in self-actualization or justice or relationship with God is key.
That's the highest level.
Short of relationship with God, as far as like how we spend our time on a daily basis, how do you identify the thing, right, for you that's either realized as self-actualization or justice?
I think that's very personal, too.
Personal, yeah, right.
I mean, you know, my wife is a therapist, right? And of all things, she decided to become a therapist to the families of incarcerated people. And a whole day she listens to this type of tsaras, which, first of all, would drive me crazy. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the worst, you know. And she loves it. You know what I mean? And I keep telling her, I said, you know, remember what Nietzsche said? You look into the abyss long enough, the abyss looks back at you. She says, when I want your advice, I'll pay for it. Everybody has their personal way of connecting to God, and everybody has their mission, and you know what I mean? And my mission is not yours, and your mission isn't mine, and you have to, you know? All the best. Thank you for inviting me.
Just a really important announcement before we go.
You're very lucky to have such a rabbi.